are listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of May 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from a Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Cordelia Lynch.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's agenda with Alessio Patilano, lecturer in war studies at King's College London. What do you have for us, Alessio?
Good morning. Well, today we have some very interesting stories, very different one from the other. First of all, we're going to be following up on the Woolwich assassination, and then the second one will be drones. We'll be going to the United States and think about what Obama said yesterday on this subject. And thirdly, we'll be looking at the sales of patrol boats from Japan to the Philippines.
So lots to discuss. The African Union also celebrates 50 years of its existence. We ponder how much there is to celebrate.
Also coming up, we learn whether what we know about the universe is based on science or fantasy.
These theories, they are literally exercises in philosophy. And as such, I don't have a problem. I think this is very stimulating and intellectually very challenging. But don't call it science.
The drama continues in Paris over the government's decision to legalize gay marriage. We get the latest from our man there.
And we find out why coffee digested by elephants in Thailand is the food he must have.
The elephant's stomach is essentially a natural fermentation tank. The result is a coffee that's floral and chocolate in the aroma. It's full-bodied without any bitter aftertaste.
All that, plus we play some music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So who doesn't love a bit of elephant dung coffee, perhaps? Lots to look forward to in the next hour or so. Before all that, here is Bill Bingham with the latest world news.
Monocle 24 News. US President Barack Obama has defended the use of drones in what he called a just war of self-defense against deadly militants. And in a renewed push to close Guantanamo Bay Detention Center on Cuba, he said he'd lifted a moratorium on prisoner transfers to Yemen. In a wide-ranging speech, Mr. Obama said the use of drones was a campaign that had made America safer, but he insisted there must be near certainty that no civilians would die in such strikes.
That U.S. strikes have resulted in civilian casualties, a risk that exists in every war. And for the families of those civilians, no words or legal construct can justify their loss. For me and those in my chain of command, those deaths will haunt us as long as we live.
Three soldiers have been killed in an ambush by suspected militants in the Pulwama district of Indian-administered Kashmir. The army says the attacks happened as troops launched an anti-insurgency operation in the Tral area, 40 kilometers from Srinagar. The Himalayan territory is claimed by both India and Pakistan. India has a large security presence in Kashmir. Suicide bombers have struck a military camp and a French-run uranium mine in two towns in northwest Niger. A bomb at a barracks in Agadez killed 19, including 18 soldiers. Areva, the operators of the Somer mine in the town of Arlift, say the attack there killed one person and injured 14. A section of a road bridge has collapsed into the Skagit River in the US state of Washington. Police say at least three people have been rescued from the water, but there were no reports of serious injuries or deaths. The four-lane bridge is near Mount Vernon, about halfway between the state's main city, Seattle, and the Canadian city of Vancouver. Reports suggest the collapse may have been triggered by a large lorry hitting part of the bridge's structure. The World Health Organization is urging countries who may have cases of novel coronavirus to share information. The call comes after Saudi Arabia said the development of diagnostic tests had been delayed by patent rights on the nCoV by commercial laboratories. The WHO says 22 deaths and 44 cases have been reported worldwide since 2012. nCoV is from the same family of viruses as the one that caused severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS. An outbreak of SARS in 2003 killed about 770 people. The National Council of the Boy Scouts of America has approved a plan to allow openly gay boys to join the organization. The vote ends a policy that's been in place throughout the group's 103-year history. However, the ban on gay and lesbian adult leaders remains in place. The new policy, supported by more than 60% of the 1,400 scout leaders who met in Texas for the organization's annual national meeting, comes into effect on January the 1st next year. Boy Scouts of America National Commissioner Tico Perez says adult membership standards have not changed.
Any gay scout can remain in scouting so long as they meet and live by the scout oath and law. The membership standards for adults are different. When a child reaches the age of 18, a boy, or 21 in venturing, they have to change their roles in this movement. They file a new application for membership. They subject themselves to a criminal background check, and they realize that the leadership role is a different role.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Bill. It's 5 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Cordelia Lynch. The time in Istanbul is 10:06. It's 9:06 in Paris, which means it's 8:06 here in London. Now it's time to set the day's news agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us in studio today is Alessio Patilano from King's College London. Welcome, Alessio, to the program. You've chosen three big stories, as we heard a little earlier. Let's start with that horrendous killing of the soldier Lee Rigby.
Yes, no, finally, as information comes in, we're getting a better picture of the situation. And I think there are three elements to the story that are quite interesting. Well, first of all, we know who the victim is. Lee Rigby, he's a drummer in the army. We heard about it, and it was quite interesting the way the MOD also talked about this person, emphasizing the fact like this is someone who's a normal person who just decided to do a certain type of job and all of a sudden find himself with no reason just, you know, being attacked in that savage way. The second element of the story that is quite intriguing is that the at least one of the persons that was involved into the attack had been on the MI5 watch list for quite some time, about 7-8 years. And the third element to this story is that he was on that watch list, and therefore now there's a number of checks being done to verify whether this is a loner, you know, a lonely person attacking, or in reality there was an element of preparation, premeditation.
And the question does seem to center now about to what extent the security services knew. There's talk of him having connections to Al-Mahajaroon, Al-Shabaab. There is even footage seeing him protesting outside a London police station. There will now be some very difficult questions levied at David Cameron about how much he knew and how much they did or didn't do.
Absolutely. And I think what is happening at the moment is being played very carefully, as you can imagine. So on one hand, this has been treated as a terrorist attack. But at the same time, the level of security is not going up because it is unclear the extent to which this is just an isolated case or the beginning of something else, which, of course, will find an answer the moment that the type of investigation you suggested is fully carried out.
And this it draws comparisons to the incident in Boston, the Boston bombers. They were watched by the FBI. They were put on a list, a very similar situation to these suspects here in the UK. But, you know, the MI6 and security services are put in a very difficult position because even though you have extremist views, you know, you can have those views, but it's difficult to then let security officials to go to the next level and actually, you know, charge them with something or you know, do something else with them. It's a very difficult situation for them they find themselves in.
Absolutely. You know, this is one of the situations where you're walking a very subtle line. one in which you have to make sure that you provide the basic guarantees to society to work effectively on one hand. On the other, when do you decide that you have to move into action? It's a very difficult thing. And as you said, you know, one could say, you know, it's a free country, you can protest and do other sorts of things. Yes, that will bring you probably on a watch list of the security services. But when do you actually move on into action and you say, well, that's no longer good enough, so we should probably take over from here? It's a very difficult question and one that will stay with us for quite some time.
And concerns now, not only of reprisals, which we have already seen the beginnings of at mosques in and around the London area, but also of potential copycat attacks.
No, absolutely. I think this is this is a tragic event, but that contains the seeds of all the contradictions that we've been, if you want, the seeds of the contradictions that we've been planting for the past decade or so, the whole war on terror thing. Because I think, you know, Prime Minister Cameron was quite right when a couple of years ago was saying, this is something that starts at home. We have to look after our communities. We have to bring people in. And I think this is the type of event that divides society in a sense that brings about a debate whereby those who feel threatened and reconsider to an extent the value of democracy and democratic expression, so to speak, and those who already felt alienated, feeling even more alienated. So this is a big task that we're looking at.
And another issue that divides a lot of people heading over to the United States is the administration, President Obama's administration, use of drones as a method to stop attacks. He had a big speech yesterday where he is trying to push back some of the use of those drones.
No, I think this is a very good point, actually. It was interesting because on the one hand, he came out really strongly in support and defense of the use of drones. But at the same time, he mentioned a couple of important changes. Well, first of all, there will be apparently higher scrutiny by an independent body or a third party to assess the extent to which the danger is actually, if the cost is worth the risk, so to speak. Sorry, the risk is worth the cost. The second element is that they're probably moving the responsibility of the use of drones away from the CIA and putting it under the command of the military, which again has to go through different sort of chain of command. And he mentioned that in his speech last night when he said that, you know, when civilian casualties come around because of the drones that we use, I bear the responsibilities. Those in my chain of command bear the responsibilities. So I think there was a clear signal in that.
And they've long been associated by the left with the excesses of the Bush administration. Do you think this is an overt attempt to get America off a war footing?
I think that is definitely the case. I was thinking about it last night when I was reading on the use of drones. And effectively, this is one of the longest conflicts we've been in for a very long time. You know, World War II was 5 years, one way or another, depending on, you know, roughly altogether, with variation, of course. But this is more than a decade. And I think the United States has to start looking forward. And in a way, it was very careful the way he put it, because he was not denying the reasons why we've done what we've done so far, but he was also saying, well, we should probably start thinking about this in a different way.
Well, that's an important point there, because some Republicans have gone that way as well, saying they're expressing concerns over this so-called shift. And they are saying it's a shift where terrorism is going to be viewed as a law enforcement problem and not anymore as a fundamental threat to the United States. Do you think that has any truth to it?
Well, I think you raise a very important point in the sense that in the discussion, the speech was not just about the drones, but it was also about Guantanamo. And what he was saying is that we should look into this and try to shut it down. And some of the Republican comments to this was like, well, we're not against the idea of shutting it down. It's just that we don't see the alternative to it. And it links back to what you were saying about, you know, the sense of fear. If we put it back into a standard law enforcement issue, then it will come back at us and all this decade will be lost in vain. But I'm not necessarily sure that that is the case, because terrorism, in a way, can't be really eradicated entirely. But now, you know, so you realise that it's gone down from the sort of a strategic problem more to a localised element. Then we go back to the story in Woolwich. It is about how we improve the condition for societies and for people to feel less alienated.
Well, moving now to an issue over territorial waters and Japan planning to donate patrol boats costing $11 million each to the Philippines. This being seen really as an attempt to ramp up regional efforts to monitor China's maritime activity in those disputed waters.
Yes, well, it is an interesting story because, it has at least three different levels. One is Japan's comeback, diplomatically speaking, to regional security. And so the sales of these patrol boats, in a way, is an interesting case of how Japan is using development aid support to other countries in the region. And the Philippines, you know, not everybody in the Philippines have good memories of last time the Japanese were around. So in a way, to build goodwill and a good image, but also become more involved in security. But there's also another level that is quite interesting, and is the one sort of bigger competition between the United States and China, and to what extent that will be useful to Japan to be regarded as someone who's contributing to American containment strategy. That is more open to debate.
Alessio Padellano, thank you very much indeed for setting the agenda for us here on Monocle 24. That was Alessio Padellano, lecturer in war studies at King's College London.
Coming up in the programme, the African Union celebrates its 50th birthday. We ask how much it's got to celebrate.
When it comes to retail, the Taiwanese capital's independent shops are increasingly worthy of attention. Monocle's filmmaker wandered down side streets to discover a myriad of new small shops, each with a concept totally their own.
The name for the Pinmo Pure Store came to founder Richard Wong in a dream. It too is a hybrid, a tiny space on a residential street in the Daan district that carries paper goods and clothing. A design agency shares the space, and tea and cookies are available even though there's no space to sit down.
Changing the city's retail landscape, one little shop at a time. Taipei Retail, in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Now, this week marks the 50th year since the founding of the African Union, an organisation set up to be a vehicle for Pan-African solidarity at a time of liberation struggle.
50 years on, the post-colonial period has ended and the African Renaissance is underway. Africa is witnessing a great change, yet challenges still persist. At this significant juncture, we ask whether the AU has been an effective force and what lies ahead for the organisation.
Well, joining us on the line now to discuss this is Martin Plaut, former Africa editor for the BBC World Service News and fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. And in the studio, we have Monocle senior editor Sophie Grove, who's twice visited the AU Parliament. Well, Martin, if I can come to you first, this is a critical juncture in the history of the African Union. How do you think its legacy will be assessed so far?
Well, I think the one thing that can never be taken away from the Organization of African Unity that used to be called and the African Union as it has become is what it did to South Africa and for South Africa. It did play a major role in the ending of apartheid and the resisting of the apartheid regime. And one shouldn't forget that Pretoria went all out to try and win support in the rest of Africa, sometimes by the gun, but frequently by money and influence. And the OAU stood up to that and was implacable in its opposition to apartheid and finally was triumphant. The other thing, of course, that one must remember is it also has become the recognized voice of Africa across the world. It is, you know, recognized by the United Nations and everyone. Now, those are the positive side of things, but there are many, many negative elements that one has to also acknowledge. And the difficulty is to see how Africa will, in a sense, overcome those in the years ahead.
Well, Martin, there's mentioning some of the that there are, indeed are negatives. Now, Sophie, you've visited the African Union's Parliament several times for Monocle. What's the sense when you're there on the ground, seeing the day's business being done? Is there a sense that this organization is able to actually accomplish many of Africa's problems, or is it, is it still kind of wait and see?
Well, I've been there a couple of times. One was during a real crisis in Darfur. I sat in session for a couple of days, and it has to be said that the panel hosted by Tabu and Becky, some of them were asleep. It did seem that there was an intractable problem with, really using the parliament then to make any real gain, mainly because there was a lot of rhetoric in the chamber about how they didn't want support, they didn't want meddling from the EU, from the UN. Africa could deal with its own problems, thank you very much. But then behind that rhetoric, there was a real sense that no one really knew how to act. They didn't want to stand up as this moral force. They didn't really have the capability at that time to really go in and sort that problem out. So there was a lot of debate and not very much action. I should say that that particular problem has sort of moved on since then, because we've seen that the AU have been very instrumental in brokering a peace between South Sudan and Sudan. Their sort of negotiation group, which is chaired by Thabo Mbeki still, has actually made significant gains in the last couple of months. So we can see that from 2009, they really have sort of got their act together and sort of established a voice and really sort of made some gains there.
Do you think, therefore, that there's more political will and perhaps an investment than there was previously?
Possibly. I think that the AU does have amazing potential. We've seen AU troops, mainly Kenyan troops, making some quite strategic gains in Somalia, for instance. And actually, Al-Shabaab did withdraw from Mogadishu in 2011, really because of the AU troops there, even though there are questions over, their fighting force, really, and also their capability. Their Peace and Security Council really does have the potential to deal with African problems. It is sort of underfunded at the moment, but actually, last time I was there, the Germans were building this amazing new facility for the Peace and Security Chamber of the AU, and there is a lot of scope for what they can do in the future.
And Martin, one interesting aspect is China's role and how they'll be playing a role in the next coming years. Secretary of State John Kerry is expressing some concern over the growing influence of China in Africa. Do you think that the African Union then will become perhaps a stronger force because of this new force or this growing influence?
Well, I mean, China is just adding to the list of countries that are interested in Africa. And I mean, one shouldn't forget that President Obama is about to make an African tour. Africa is growing, or predicted to grow at 6.1% next year. So everybody's very keen on Africa and sees it as a place in which to make money. But I must, take issue with Sophie. You know, I think that the Peace and Security Council, while it has considerable possibilities, has really essentially failed in its task. If you look at the standby brigades, which were designed by the Security Council to act as the armed force of the African Union, when they came to the major tests, one was in Mali, the other was in Ivory Coast, they failed on both occasions. And this was because regional powers were simply not prepared to give to the African Union the force of the legitimacy to send those troops in. Ghana blocked the one in Ivory Coast, the other one in Mali they dithered, and on both occasions they required the French and the United Nations to come to their rescue. Now that is an atrocious behavior on the part of the African Union, letting down the people of Africa at the moment when they required most assistance. It was absolutely vital that they acted, and they failed.
Unfortunately, we're running out of time, so we'll have to leave it there. To both of you, thank you very much. Martin Plaut, former Africa editor for BBC World Service News and a fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies, and of course, Monocle's senior editor, Sophie Grove. Thanks very much to both of you. Now, get ready to blow your mind. Super systemic quarks, multiverse, cosmic quantum physics. Are you slightly confused?
I definitely am. I hope you're going to explain.
Well, these are just a few of the terms used to put some sort of definition behind theories of modern-day quantum physics. To your average layman, including myself, and Cordelia, maybe you as well, it can indeed boggle the mind. But what if these so-called scientific theories aren't that scientific after all?
Well, a new book by science writer Jim Baggard is challenging the notions of what we think we know and, perhaps more importantly, why we've been made to think that. Farewell to Reality, How Fairy Tale Physics Betray the Search for Scientific Truth is out now, and Phil caught up with Jim at Midori House for a lesson in physics.
It's actually not so very, very difficult to get your head around the motivation. I got very angry sitting watching a BBC documentary that was titled What is Reality? And that seems like a fairly simple and straightforward question. And indeed, the program began relatively straightforwardly with some recent developments in particle physics and some of the more bizarre but factually correct observations of quantum mechanics. And then really did go off a little bit at a tangent. It was really a kind of roller coaster ride through all of the elaborate and rather esoteric but contemporary theories that are intended to allow us to understand what reality is. These include superstring theory, supersymmetry, multiverse theory, the idea that there might be parallel universes. And I got really rather cross and started to shout at my TV because the simple fact of the matter is there are no empirical foundations for any of these elaborate theories whatsoever. And yet this is passed off in the media and in popular science books as being scientifically very valid. And I thought the time had come maybe to make a stand, point a little bit, a finger at what might be emperor's new clothes and say, look, guys, let's be clear that if we have an understanding of what we think we know when we talk about science, let's be clear that there are some criteria that a scientific theory should meet. And this book really just tries to set the record straight by whatever criteria you want to imagine are relevant to describe what science is. These theories are barely scientific. They're exercises in metaphysics. They're exercises in sophistry and illusion.
But I guess the key word there is theory. And these scientists do say that these are theories.
Sure.
They're not trying to argue that it's fact. So if they're admitting that it's just a theory, what's the big problem with it?
Sure. I mean, it's a very legitimate question. And the one thing that I would say is that science has evolved since its inception about 400 or even 500 years ago, depending on how far back you want to go, on the interplay between theory and observation and experiment. But science progresses because our theorists develop theories that are anchored. They seek to explain facts that we can observe, facts about the universe, facts about elementary particles that we can detect at CERN in Geneva, for example. These theories have been developed really over the last 30 or 40 years and actually are beginning to get into a situation where they don't have any pretensions to connect to anything that we could observe or anything that we could experimentally determine. They are literally exercises in philosophy. And as such, I don't have a problem. I think this is very stimulating and intellectually very challenging, but don't call it science.
So what's behind this so-called transformation then in the last few years from ideas of it just being theories and people accepting that those are theories to now suddenly, in your opinion, I guess, the media is, as one part of it, saying that these are now turned into theories, into fact and science? What's behind all that?
One of the simple, or maybe rather simplistic explanations, is the present situation we find ourselves in. Something that looks very much like the Higgs boson was discovered at CERN just in July last year. And the evidence that was collected at the Large Hadron Collider over the course of last year has simply lent a degree of belief that this is indeed a Higgs boson. It may not necessarily be the Higgs boson as demanded by the standard model of particle physics. But arguably what this does is it effectively proves that there does exist a particle that was hypothesized in theories that were built in the early 1970s. The issue is that we know that in the structures that have been developed to describe the universe, to describe elementary material substance, these are great theories. They've stood the test of time, but we know they can't be the final answer, that they're full of problems, conundrums. They don't fit together. It's impossible to fit Einstein's general relativity, which describes the large-scale structure of the universe, with theories of elementary fundamental particles. The forces don't fit together.
Isn't that the basis behind these theories in science, perhaps, is that it's constantly evolving over time?
For sure. But what's happened in the hundreds of years that science has existed as a discipline is that the theories have evolved in relation to facts. We've seen something that doesn't fit, and we've had to adapt the theories to fit. Here we've run out of facts. There aren't really that many facts that can't be described by the current set of theories, but we know the current set of theories can't be the final answer. So in pushing for a final answer, in pushing for a final theory of everything, we've gone beyond the facts. It's very, very simple, I think. In going beyond the facts, we find ourselves in a situation where it's no longer possible for these theorists to tie their theories back to reality.
So have we reached the boundary then of science?
Have we reached the end of science? You know, there have been moments in history, not least there was the famous, although rather apocryphal, story of Lord Kelvin addressing the British Association for the Advancement of Science in 1900, saying basically there's nothing left for physicists to do. Of course, what then followed was a whole century of spectacular discovery. So it'd be foolish to sit here and say, no, this is the end of physics. This is the end of discovery. I think there's still a lot that we can find out within the limits that are of the technologies that are available to us today. I think the issue is that what we've got to recover is the discipline and way of thinking about the problems that do exist within the current theoretical structures in a way that helps us to make some progress. At the moment, we've run off, it seems, at a tangent. We're so blown away by the idea that we might live in a multiverse, for example, that we're trying to explain every bit of quirk in the data in terms of multiverse theories. There was an example literally just this weekend, an article in the Sunday Times and in the online Daily Mail saying that new hard evidence had been found that we exist in a multiverse. Honestly, complete nonsense. There are plenty of alternative explanations for some of this information, but this is the current obsession. This is the kind of paradigm that we're experiencing at the moment. And the book is really just designed as a counterpoint to that. It's just saying, hang on, let's be a little bit skeptical about some of this stuff. Where's the proof? Where's the validation? Where's the evidence based on something that we can really say is a hard and fast prediction coming from these theories and compare that with data? There is none. And the book is really just meant to provoke some debate.
So Cordelia, what do you make of multiverse dimensions? Are you a fan? Are you a believer?
A fan. I'm a massive convert.
You,
by multiverse, you're referring to a form of poetry or...
I'm talking quantum physics here, Cordelia.
That I know slightly less about.
Well, maybe you should pick up Jim's book, perhaps. That was Jim Baggett speaking to me earlier, author of Farewell to Reality, How Fairy Tale Physics Betrays the Search for Scientific Truth.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
Now, in the next half hour of the programme, we hear the latest from Paris and the must-drink coffee that's scavenged from elephant dung. Very strange indeed, but do listen, it should be interesting. But first, here's Bill Bingham with the news headlines.
US President Barack Obama has defended the use of drones in what he called a just war of self-defense against deadly militants. And in a renewed push to close the Guantanamo Bay detention center on Cuba, he said he'd lifted a moratorium on prison transfers to Yemen. Three soldiers have been killed in an ambush by suspected militants in the Pulwama district of Indian-administered Kashmir. The army says the attacks happened as troops launched an anti-insurgency operation in the Tral area, 40 kilometres from Srinagar. Suicide bombers have struck a military camp and a French-run uranium mine in two towns in northwest Niger. A bomb at a barracks in Agadez killed 19, including 18 soldiers. Areva, the operators of the Somair mine in the town of Arlit, say the attack there killed one person and injured 14. A section of road bridge has collapsed into the Skagit River in the US state of Washington. Police say at least three people have been rescued from the water, but there are no reports of serious injuries or deaths. Reports suggest the collapse may have been triggered by a large lorry hitting part of the bridge's structure. The World Health Organization is urging countries who may have cases of novel coronavirus to share information. The call comes after Saudi Arabia said the development of diagnostic tests had been delayed by patent rights on the nCoV by commercial laboratories. The National Council of the Boy Scouts of America has approved a plan to allow openly gay boys to join the organization. The vote ends a policy that's been in place throughout the group's 103-year history. However, the ban on gay and lesbian adult leaders remains in place. And those are the latest headlines here on Monocle 24.
Yo, You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Cordelia Lynch, and Phil Hahn.
The time is 8:34 here in London, which makes it 9:34 in Paris, where we're going to head to next. Let's talk to our man there, Tom Burgess-Watson, is in Paris. Welcome, Tom, to the program. Let's begin with one of the stories you've selected for us. Are we hearing the chim-chongium of wedding bells across the streets of France, perhaps?
Indeed. Well, I think this story's got quite confusing for people to follow because Mariage pour tous, or Marriage for All, was approved, and it had to go to the upper chamber in Parliament. Then it was signed, and then it was challenged, and now it's really happening. So I thought I would just mention this story because last Saturday, President Hollande signed that Marriage for All Act, and making France the 14th country in the world to legalize same-sex marriage. But, you know, we were saying at the time, you know, in the news here in France that, you know, it would be some time before the first actual marriage happened. And now we've got a date for that. It's the 29th of May, so that's next Wednesday. Vincent and Bruno are going to tie the knot in Montpellier, which is to the south of France. And it's going to be a fairly star-studded event, lots of politicians and movie stars and so on who've lent their support to the campaign will be there because it's a very symbolic day here in France, Wednesday the 29th of May. But there are concerns that nevertheless there could be interruptions to that wedding because let's not forget this whole debate has triggered some of the largest conservative and right-wing protests in 3 decades, and we've got more protests despite the fact this has been signed into law set for the 26th of May, which is Sunday. So we might well see some unrest, and the organizers of that debate until now have said don't be civilly disobedient, if that exists as a phrase. And this time they really are calling for civil disobedience. So it's interesting that although it's become law and then that's the end of the story in many respects, the protests continue.
Yes, and we have already, of course, seen those dramatic events at Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris with a high-profile suicide. What's the climate like now?
Well, I think people were extremely shocked that someone had chosen Notre Dame as a place to commit suicide and in quite such a spectacular way. This was the right-wing historian Dominique Venner, who at the age of 78 walked up to the altar in Notre Dame, which is the most visited site in the French capital, more than the Eiffel Tower, more than anywhere else, perhaps because you'd have to pay to get in, so they get more visitor numbers than anywhere else. He went up to the altar, put a letter there, and shot himself in the head. But he was a staunch opponent of same-sex marriage. He's also an anti-immigration figure and you know, very much in the camp of Marine Le Pen, Le Front National, the far-right wing group here in France. Marine Le Pen said that was a respectful act, and she said that what he was trying to do was to wake up the people of France. So she's really sort of saluting his act at Notre Dame, which I think took a lot of people by surprise.
It indeed was a horrific event there at the cathedral. But the day after, there was another suicide, but this time a reenactment of a suicide by a women's protest group.
Yeah, this was another extraordinary event in what was a pretty extraordinary week here in Paris, really. A topless activist from this group called Femen, which I think they've made quite a name for themselves turning up at events around the world, but here in France they've become particularly popular for turning up at right-wing, far-right-wing protests and rallies. They were at a Joan of Arc memorial service a few days ago, topless and interrupting the events there. And then this lady from the Ukraine walked into Notre Dame the very, you know, exactly 24 hours after that suicide, and she reenacted a mock suicide in the same spot. She put a pretend gun in her mouth, and written across her bare chest was scrawled in pen, "May fascists rest in hell." So this was a really extraordinary gest, you know, just in the same spot that someone had killed themselves just 24 hours earlier. And Femen issued a statement saying, "Perhaps all European Nazis and fascists could follow that example of the ultra-right-wing Dominic Venner and commit suicide, although they made it clear that they meant that in a metaphorical sense, more sort of purging themselves of their political beliefs. So a very surprising turn of events there.
Excellent stuff, Tom. Tom Burgess-Watson there in Paris. Thanks very much for bringing us the latest news headlines out of France.
Jump aboard the June issue of Monocle as we look at the future of transport. From sleek planes to high-speed trains, utilitarian scooters to city cars. Our annual transport survey is just the ticket if you want to know how Manila plans to fix its metropolitan traffic mayhem, where to find the best airport in China, or how to build the perfect suburban railway station.
In the culture section, we jump headfirst into Asia's unsung music industry. It turns out Thailand is pop world and its singers are gorgeous. We'll also meet one of Turkey's most discerning art collectors, Oslo's greatest artist, and the editor of Spain's troubled but bullish daily, El País.
In the design section, we visit House Vision, Kenya Hara's groundbreaking exhibition in Tokyo that asks if Japan can sell homes to the world. We also deconstruct the design of Hazelay bikes in the Netherlands, and we review the Salone del Mobile and Basel Watch Fair too.
In the edit section, we go to Modena, not to buy a sports car, but to embark on a gastronomic tour with the best chef in town, Massimo Bottura. We also travel to Japan to check out the refurbished Tokyo Midtown before looking at property in Brussels. All this on board spanking new aircrafts from Sri Lankan carrier Air Cinnamon.
The June issue of Monocle is on newsstands now. Or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com now to find out how to sign up.
Now, in this week's episode of The Menu, there's a bit of an Icelandic theme. Fresh from his trip to Reykjavik, Marcus Hippie will be tasting a number of Icelandic delicacies, including fermented shark, sampling some of the best coffee to be found on the island, and discovering the intricacies of farming on volcanic soil.
Fermented shark. Would you ever try fermented shark, Cordelia?
Give it a go, but I don't think it would be the most appealing thing on the menu.
Well, if you don't think that's appealing, wait till you hear what we have coming up. Because in this preview, we're heading from Iceland to Asia. Now, it may not sound like an exclusive beverage, but coffee from elephant dung, believe it or not, has become the must-drink product at many of Asia's five-star hotels. Now, according to its inventor, when elephants digest the coffee cherries, the bitterness is removed, making for a much-improved cuppa. Black Ivory Coffee is the brainchild of Canadian entrepreneur Blake Dinkin, who works with an elephant sanctuary in northern Thailand to produce the world's most expensive coffee. Well, Nick Martin met up with him at the Grand Hyatt in Bangkok, one of the first hotels to stock his brand.
What we have here is a coffee brewing machine that dates back to 1840. It was invented in, some say Austria, some say France. And what this is, among the coffee geeks of the world, this is probably the best way to brew coffee. And it looks like a cross between a grade 12 science experiment and kind of a colonial piece. And what you have is, you have two chambers. One's a copper pot with a tube and then a glass jar. And underneath that is a Bunsen burner. So what happens is there's water that's put into the copper kettle, Bunsen burner is lit, heats the water up. And why geeks love it is the temperature of the water hits 93 degrees, which is the ideal temperature for coffee extraction. As the water evaporates, steam's created, it moves through the pipe into the glass chamber. And it's has a balancing mechanism to it. So as the water evaporates, the copper kettle gets lighter, and what'll happen is it'll move up and shut the flame and it'll extinguish the flame. Then a vacuum will be created and it will actually suck the coffee back through the pipe, through the cloth filter, back into the original copper kettle, and then you've got your coffee.
Amazing. Having this contraption here really does add to the experience of trying elephant dung coffee. But at the same time, you know, I can't get over the fact that this coffee has actually passed through an elephant. There must be other people that can't believe this is actually true.
There are some people out there who think that this is just some kind of novelty or gag. And I would say to them, there's actually quite a bit of science that goes on behind this. And there's two main things happening. The first is elephants, when they're digesting the food, there's an enzymatic reaction that occurs. And the what's happening is the enzymes break down the protein found in coffee. And protein is one factor responsible for bitterness. So less protein means a less bitter tasting coffee. The second thing that happens is elephants are herbivores, and herbivores, to break down the kind of green leafy matter that they eat, use a lot of fermentation. And fermentation's great because it helps infuse the fruit into the bean. So that happens with regular coffee as well, but the elephant's stomach is essentially a natural fermentation tank. And really the result is a coffee that's floral and chocolate in the aroma. It's full-bodied with lingering notes of chocolate without any bitter aftertaste.
Okay, so how big a business is this and how fast is the idea taking off?
We produced 70 kilos last year, and this year we will have produced 300 kilos. This is very much an artisanal endeavor. It's not meant to compete with, you know, products you might find in Starbucks. We hope to be able to get it up maybe 1 metric ton eventually, but we want to make sure it's produced ethically. We want to make sure we've got the buy-in of the elephant owners and the mahouts and the foundation, and we want to make sure that the beans have actually gone through the elephants. So all of this takes time and getting a system in place, and as well as to operate transparently so that people can see that we're, you know, you really are getting the real thing and that there's a strong attention to quality.
Okay, so how many elephants are you going to need to ramp up production?
We, at the Golden Triangle Asian Elephant Foundation, there's 26 elephants. We use about 20 of them, 15 to 20 elephants. And of the 26, about 18 have actually been rescued from the street. So the foundation has saved a lot of these elephants by taking them off the street, providing refuge for them, providing a home for the families who own them. And that's why we donate 8% of our sales back to the sanctuary, as well as provide income generation for the wives of the elephant owners, to try to make a difference in the lives of the elephants and their families.
You were telling me that it's taken 10 years to bring this product to market and $400,000 of your own money. You must have a pretty good idea now of the typical black ivory coffee drinker. And I just wonder what kind of response you're getting from them and from the hotels that you're selling into.
They're going to want to be, they have to be open-minded, adventurous, affluent enough to want to spend the extra money for the coffee. It's probably someone who likes telling a good story. And as far as the hotels, they actually, it's been really, really positive because it allows hotels to distinguish themselves from the competition. The fact that we give back and support the Elephant Sanctuary is something that they really stand behind because it talks to their corporate social responsibility. And they're always looking to provide something a little bit different for their guests. And really, we're trying to move away from what happens every day where people are always in a rush. They're bombarded with all kinds of messages. And we're trying to create a little bit of refuge, I guess, where you can take your 10 minutes or 15 minutes or frankly, however long you want, and just sit back, great smell, a bit of theater, you know, great tasting coffee, and feeling good about what you've just purchased.
Now let's bring in Mark de Leeuwerk, director of F&B at the Grand Hyatt Bangkok. Mark, I'm interested to know what's been the reaction from your customers. Is it difficult for a 5-star hotel to sell elephant dung coffee?
Not really. I think by now a lot of people will have known Kopi Luau, the Balinese version of the civet cat coffee, and then that's increasing in popularity as well. So it's not a totally unknown phenomenon. And actually, from as far as what I gather, the reactions that I see, people find it more interesting than anything else. That not that it's off-putting in any way, no.
And how have sales been?
Sales have been above expectation. We weren't expecting to sell, you know, tens of the bags a day, but definitely more than expected. We sell the actual coffee machine. We sell the bags, the coffee beans in takeaway bags for people to take home, and we sell the experience in the Erewhon Tea Room when we prepare from A to Z, grind the coffee, brew the coffee, and serve it, and tell the story. So actually on all fronts, it's doing very well. It's something that we like to promote in the outlets, and also if people have a coffee in the Erewhon tea room, some of them actually end up buying a couple of bags to take home and share with their families and their friends.
I don't know about that, Cordelia.
Yeah, it's an interesting debate. I was just reading about civets in Asia, where they also produce a very popular coffee there. But
it's like the Asian palm civet, which is like a type of kind of wild cat, almost resembling a lemur.
Yeah, there has been kind of allegations of them force-feeding coffee berries. So there's an interesting debate to be had over that, I think.
Yeah, I'll stick to my regular Monocle Cafe coffee.
Yeah, get the brand in there, yeah. Young man. Now, more far-flung foodie stories will be coming to you on today's premiere of The Menu. You can catch that at 1900 hours in London, 1500 hours in Sao Paulo, and 1100 in San Francisco.
And waiting in the wings is a very special guest. It's Monocle editor Andrew Tuck. He'll be reviewing this morning's British front pages. But before all that, here's time for a little bit of music. Here's Bastille with their song Pompeii. Around us, and the walls kept tumbling down in the city that we love. If you close your eyes, does it almost feel like nothing changed at all? And if you close your eyes, does it almost... And that was Pompeii by Bastille. It's just turned 8:52 in the morning here in London, which means it's time for a flick through this morning's British front pages. We're now joined by Monocle editor Andrew Tuck. Good morning, Andrew.
With sound effects. Lots of rustling there, wasn't there?
I like rustling.
Creates a sense of drama.
A bit of drama, yeah, exactly.
I've kind of made a bed of newspapers here for myself. I could tuck down if it...
Well, if you get a bit sleepy, you can just nod off.
Well, it's often quite cold in the studio, so it's quite good to have one you can use as a blanket on your knees, even.
So you've got a couple of the papers there. Have you heard of? Let's start, though, with this interesting story about, believe it or not, olive oil.
Well, this is one of those stories that normally would kind of dog most national papers, right-wing press, you know, this kind of belief that the EU is kind of, you know, bringing out legislation that people don't want, and, you know, you'd get a lot of harumphing about it. But this is an instance where they did come up with a piece of legislation which is just so disconnected from what ordinary people think. But in fact, I think everybody has just kind of lambasted them. They came up with the idea that from next year, it would be impossible for any restaurant to serve olive oil in a bowl. And often, as you go to a restaurant, they'll give you a little bowl of olive oil and some bread. Now, that was going to become illegal. And the thinking behind it was that for, you know, Spanish and Italian producers, it would be clear that the bottle was plonked on the table and you'd see where the olive oil would come from. And so people couldn't claim to be giving you Italian olive oil when, in fact, they may be giving you something cheaper. Now, maybe one or two producers thought this was a good idea. It kind of went through on a quiet nod. And then suddenly when people realised what was happening, it's the same as the curly banana story, when it was like there was going to be a ban on straight bananas. Mm. That you think these things are absolutely mythical, but in this case, it's a true story. They really did believe that this was a bad thing to do.
And really a policy that's yet again attracted quite a lot of ridicule. David Cameron, from the very beginning, really, was accusing the EU of meddling. It's yet another story that you can imagine in the pages of the right-wing press, as you say.
Well, what's interesting is, you know, that, you know, for people like David Cameron, who at this time are in a very difficult position. They're trying to... He wants to kind of stay in the EU, but he wants to renegotiate the deal that the UK has with the EU. Now, lots of other countries in the EU are also kind of suddenly a bit cautious about their relationship with the EU. They, you know, that it hasn't quite gone to plan. And when things like this come along, suddenly it makes it very difficult for them to argue in a logical way, because this is what all the press is about. This is the olive oil gets the headlines. It, you know, the money perhaps going to kind of help poor regions doesn't get talked about, because that's a boring story and nobody cares unless they live in that region. But when you get something like this, you get a kind of fanatical coverage from it. And it just doesn't help national leaders who are trying to present the EU as a body that does good things.
And another story, of course, Apple Computer has been in the headlines this week for paying very low rates of tax. But it looks like Apple are again in the headlines, but this time for a different reason.
Well, this is a way that perhaps Apple could, if they ever have to raise more money for their taxes, could get some. There's going to be an auction in Germany this weekend, and it includes one of the very first Apple computers. Now, originally, you could have bought this for $666. That was the asking price, which is about $2,700 in today's money. But now, an Apple One computer recently sold for $640,000.
Wow. Unbelievable. It seems a type of kind of techno-fetishism.
Yeah, that's how it is being described. And they're saying there's this kind of the world of the geek. You know, many of these people are actually, they've come up through the industry, that they've made huge fortunes, and they see these as the kind of icons of their age, and these are the things that made all their careers possible. So suddenly that.
If you have any stuff in the garage under a couple of boxes, you should take it out and.
Well, I watched a program about hoarding last night. There was there was a gentleman there, I think, that may have several of them kind of tucked into his garage and under his bed as well.
He could be a multimillionaire.
If only he could find them.
Yeah. Have you got time for another one?
We do indeed.
Well, this is another story of kind of British eccentricity, rather, and gone awry. There's a grandmother who's in her 80s, who every year she makes a giant cheese to be rolled down a hill, and people go running down the cheese after the hill. It seems that lots of people fall over and get hurt. So yesterday, the police went to see her, and they gave her an official warning. They said, they advised her, Diana Smart, 86, she's been told not to give a wheel of cheese to anybody who comes calling, because if she does, she could be implicated in any accidents that take place.
I have indeed been to this cheese rolling competition.
I have eaten cheese.
Yeah, I have eaten cheese. Only occasionally, usually late at night. It is, scenes of carnage at that event, actually.
There's so many of those bizarre events where they see, like, who can roll down the hill the fastest, or who can carry, who can do the most flips or somersaults down hills. It's just a bizarre thing.
I've seen you on that challenge, how many gin and tonics in an hour. you're quite well at that.
Two and I'm done. Andrew, you have time for just one more story if you want to get one.
A little bit more seriously, there was an announcement being made that there was a point during the winter when the British only had 6 hours worth of gas left in storage as a buffer. And this is, some people are saying actually it was a little bit more. And the way that the market works, you can pump in gas much quicker. But an extraordinary thing where all these countries are concerned about their energy security. And here we have the British saying, actually, it could have been down to just 6 hours of power left.
Well, it still feels like winter, I think, this morning, is something like 5 degrees.
I came in with the same clothes on I had in February, so.
Unbelievable. Well, still look
great. They were
great.
Washed.
You still look great.
Yeah.
You still look great. Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks to our producers, Annabelle Bly and Barbara Feeney. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was the ever-talented Chris Fitch. Up next after the news is Section D with Alid John, Poppy Trowbridge, and myself. We'll be back with Midori House at the same time on Monday. But for me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Cordelia Lynch. Thanks for listening.
Goodbye. Bye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.